Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland family. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. Michael Balaban and Raphael Orlov spend their days thinking about cars. They drive lots of different cars and write about them for the automotive website Jalopnik. So it makes sense that even though they live in New York City, they both own cars. Cool ones, too. Raphael has a 1974 Volkswagen Beetle in an unusual color.
Somewhere between a seafoam and a robin's egg blue.
And Michael's ride is almost a collector's item.
I have a 2002 Lexus station wagon, which they did make. I promise they made it briefly. And I really like it because, you know, it's a wagon, but it's also a sporty little car.
Beyond taking us from point A to point B, for lots of people, cars are a way to make a statement about yourself, your way of life. So what do these cars say about them? Raphael, with the ancient VW, goes first.
It says I'm a wistful idiot who is optimistic, probably to a fault. It tells people that I think I can probably figure out whatever horrible problem is just around the corner.
And Michael, your Lexus station wagon, what does that tell me about you?
Oh gosh, it probably tells people that I'm desperately trying to prove to people that I'm interesting.
See, this is what I find so interesting. It's just a normal blue station wagon.
Except it isn't. It's very, very rare here. Mm-hmm. It's a station wagon, so it is practical, but it's front engine, rear wheel drive, so it's fun.
But these signifiers, they matter. You see them more than 90% of the people on the street.
Oh, God, yeah.
These little details matter for lots of car owners.
They form bonds with these cars. They name their cars.
Cars can also be a major source of stress, like the time the check engine light came on in Michael's station wagon for no apparent reason.
My check engine light was sitting there glowing orange, staring at me, as it were.
Night and day.
Night and day.
In your dreams.
Telling me. Something was wrong in my life.
With you.
Right, with me. And even if there was nothing that was really wrong, the car was running great. It was just, you know, one of those computer faults. It drove me insane because something in my life was wrong, and it would always be wrong until I could fix it.
It can feel like cars play an outsized role in our lives, right? But think about it. They've changed most aspects of modern life. Where we live, work, shop, how we spend our free time. We're dependent on them. They cost a lot of money. And their presence has had an impact on our health and stress levels. There's air pollution, noise, traffic, accidents. Freeways and roads are carving up green spaces. On today's show, we'll explore how cars continue to affect our lives and which aspects may be changing. All of the negatives that are associated with cars, the congestion, the pollution, noise, they feel more noticeable and grating in cities. Car exhaust has been linked to childhood asthma. Many researchers have pointed to cars as a culprit in rising obesity rates. The asphalt of streets and parking lots creates rainwater runoff. Still, cars have been king of the road for decades, but there is some pushback. Jad Slayman has more.
Kids skate around, dart back and forth, playing tag and soccer. They scream for no apparent reason. It feels like a playground at recess, but it's a city street, 78th Street to be exact, in Jackson Heights, New York City. Almost a whole block of it has been closed to car traffic since 2011. 8-year-old Alexandria and her friends pass around a volleyball. This is her favorite part of the neighborhood.
Because, like, it's large. And also, like, I get to have space to play soccer and other different sports.
Jackson Heights is a diverse, densely packed part of Queens. It's got far less park space than almost every other city neighborhood. Alexandria's cousin Sarah is old enough to remember playing on this block before the closure.
It wasn't really much, and it was kind of hard because, like, with the cars passing by, I don't know, like, I was kind of scared because, let's say, a ball, like, flew over. No, I didn't want to be in the traffic.
When the city blocked off the street for the first time, Sarah says it was weird.
Because, like, we're not used to it because I was so used to cars passing by.
It was a good kind of weird.
Yeah, it was a good kind of weird.
Locals don't think it's weird anymore. In fact, they want more of the street. They're fighting for it. Officials had promised to close the whole block eventually. Standing in their way now, of all things, is a car dealership at one end. They opened last year and want to keep cars flowing in and out of a service entrance. But locals refuse to back down. A group of activists first started working on closing the street more than a decade ago, and there was a lot of pushback.
There was fear that we were going to lose parking places. There was fear that we were going to cause traffic on adjacent streets. There was fear that there was going to be, all of a sudden, even though there's not really problems with gang activity in this park, that all of a sudden there's going to be, like, gang turf battles in this street.
That's Donovan Finn, an urban planning professor who was part of the push and lived in the neighborhood. Gatekeepers, as he calls them, city officials, community board members, thought he was nuts.
There's something about when you tell people you're going to close a piece of street, I think it just creates this, the situation in their mind where they just can't fathom it. It just seems so unlikely that you could just turn a street into a public space that they just can't imagine it.
The thing is, Donovan was waging a kind of insurgency in a war cars had won decades ago. It was a battle over who the streets were for, and about 100 years ago, it was life and death.
The automobiles were killing people at an incredible rate.
That's Peter Norton, a technology historian and author of Fighting Traffic, a book about how cars made their way into our cities in the first place.
And in cities, the people getting killed were overwhelmingly pedestrians. Many of them were children.
Back then, cars were seen as these pleasure machines reserved for the reckless and the ultra-rich. And people had different ideas about what a street was supposed to be in the 1910s. If you had taken a satellite photo of an older city back then, Peter says you would see a lot of the same grid patterns we see today. But at street level, it was a different world.
There were no lanes, no center lines, no line markings. People could stroll where they wanted. And I think it would have given you the impression of being something like a busy, small public park.
New York's Museum of Modern Art has black and white footage of Manhattan streets shot in 1911. The first thing you notice is everyone is wearing a fancy hat of some kind, even the kids. And the second thing, the streets are filled with people. There's the occasional streetcars or Model Ts, but no one looks out for them or even makes an effort to get out of their way. Probably because early traffic laws made cars super slow.
In the 8 or 10 mile an hour range, I mean, extremely slow by our standards.
If you can just outrun a car, you're not going to buy one. So a couple things started happening. First, car companies lobbied against laws restricting automobiles and for laws restricting pedestrians. We get jaywalking. Kansas City tried strict enforcement in 1912. People used to owning the streets were offended. Angry.
There's one episode where women struck police officers with their parasols for being told not to walk in the street.
So Peter says officials added an element of public shaming. Here's how one Los Angeles official went about it.
He even recommended that if it was a woman jaywalker, that the police officer should pick her up and carry her back to the curb, because he said this would be so humiliating that it would prevent her from jaywalking ever again.
At the same time, electric streetcar networks were in decline as coal prices rose. It became cheaper to ride in a jitney, a low-cost, unofficial taxi. Think Uber before Uber. And cars got cheaper, too.
The private automobile, even though still relatively few people were driving their own car to work, it didn't take very many of such people to get in the way of the streetcars.
Public transit was getting stuck in traffic and becoming less convenient. In the 50s, lawmakers subsidized thousands of miles of highway.
The phase of the act is the interstate highway system, a 41,000-mile network of our most important roads.
It was tied to defense, the ability to move tanks quickly in case of invasion. But the final victory for cars, Peter says, was a psychological one that started with the kids. By the mid-20s, the top funder of public school safety education was the American Automobile Association, AAA.
They took over the safety patrols, guided the children to school, and helped them cross the street safely. And their message to children was, streets are for automobiles.
When these kids grew into adults, that was ingrained in them. They simply knew the streets were for cars. And the rest is history. Peter isn't a big fan of cars. I expected him to bike to the office. He works in this sprawling college town. But no, he backs out of his driveway in a four-wheel internal combustion automobile.
And I think that quite arguably makes me a total hypocrite. But my answer is that, like other people, I have to live in the world we've got.
Cars won. That's the world we live in. Peter says public investment in cars has come at the detriment of other ways to get around. Millions like him have no train they can walk to, no reliable bus. They can't pedal along a freeway from the suburbs. In big cities, public transit is often underfunded and struggling. But have cars won for good?
Somewhere around 2003, 2004, I began to notice that people were driving a little less in New York City. And soon I began to notice they were driving less in cities around the country.
That's Sam Schwartz, a.k.a. Gridlock Sam. He's the New York urban planner who coined the term gridlock. Driving had dipped before, during the Great Depression or wars, but always recovered and grew very quickly. Driving also decreased during the latest recession, which Sam says was expected. But then, after the recovery, when you'd expect rates to shoot right back up, they didn't. And that hadn't happened before.
Millennials were driving 20 to 25% fewer miles, not just 1 to 2%, which is when you see shifts, they're usually very gradual. This was a quantum jump.
Federal data shows rates continued to drop, except among the poorest millennials. Sam says that tells him younger Americans are rethinking their relationship with cars. Cars are not part of the American dream for them. And cities are thinking about reducing cars too, and not just the usual suspects, the New Yorks and Chicagos. Smaller cities are reaching out to him.
Fargo, North Dakota, Boise, Idaho, Des Moines, Iowa, Grand Rapids, Michigan.
They want to know how to get by with fewer cars. Sam knows a thing or two about that. In the 70s, he tried and almost succeeded in getting cars out of a huge chunk of Midtown Manhattan, some 60 blocks.
All cars were going to be banned from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m.
He got so far as stamping out the signs, but a new mayor scrapped it last minute. Hotel owners pushed back, and really, it was just too radical. Instead, only Madison Avenue closed, and only temporarily, starting on Earth Day.
And all the mad men and mad women of the early 1970s came out during lunchtime with sandwiches, picnics, bottles of wine, and enjoyed the fresh air on Madison Avenue that probably hadn't been seen in nearly a century.
The picnics came and went, but Sam says his ideas aren't so radical anymore. It's not a car ban, but in April, New York officials announced congestion pricing was coming to Manhattan.
New York City is set to become the very first city in the nation to levy a congestion tax on drivers.
You shoved this down my throat just like you shoved the bicycle lanes down my throat, and now you want me to pay for it.
Drivers would be charged roughly 10 bucks for driving into the city, anywhere between 60th Street, where we are now, down to the tip of Manhattan.
The fees go to public transit. The idea is less car traffic in urban centers, and it's worked in Singapore and London. American cities are watching New York's experiment, and with good reason. In big downtowns, cars are slowing to a crawl. The average speed in Midtown Manhattan last year, 4.7 miles per hour. That's slower than your average jogger. Experts point to the influx of Lyfts and Ubers, more solo car trips. So Sam tells me we're at a crossroads. Younger generations aren't as in love with cars as their parents, and we can't pave our way out of congestion anymore.
Over 40, now almost 50 years, what we've seen is the failure of trying to build more roads. If we go to Houston, where they kept widening the Katy Freeway to the point where now it has 26 lanes and the traffic is worse. It didn't work.
It opened in 2008, and it's likely still the world's widest freeway. Traffic got better at first, but eventually slowed back down. If you build it, they will come and clog it right back up.
Do you get up in the morning and you're like, thank God I get to go sit in my car for an hour in traffic?
That's Lynn Richards, president of the Congress for New Urbanism.
Nobody wants that as an outcome.
They're a collective of engineers, policy wonks, and scientists. They fret over what cars have done to our cities and, by extension, our health and environment. But they're not anti-car exactly. They just oppose prioritizing them over other kinds of transport, putting highways before rail lines, parking over bike lanes.
I'm not asking you to give up your car. I have a car. I like my car. I drive my car. I also love the fact that I can get to work faster on my bike than any other mode of transportation. So we're talking about creating choices on how to get around.
She says public fear is the biggest obstacle to reclaiming streets from cars.
It's going to be like gang turf battles in this street.
Yeah. Lynn says one way around that, get tactical.
It's called tactical urbanism.
Start with small car-free spaces and make it temporary so no one freaks out.
If you wanted to narrow a street in a downtown area instead of, oh my gosh, what happens to the parking, et cetera, you use hay bales and temporary seating and paint to transform the street.
78th Street in Queens, that actually started as a temporary thing too. Couple weekends in the summer, then the whole summer, then, hey, why not the whole year?
Very quickly, you know, kids are learning to ride bikes here. People were having birthday parties for their kids.
That's Donovan again, one of the activists behind the 78th Street closure.
People were having picnics on this asphalt. You know, it's not really that inviting, but people were doing it. Just because of the linear shape of it, people were setting up soccer goals at each end and having, having soccer games.
The most encouraging thing to him, the kids on 78th Street who have never thought of it as a street.
To them, this is just how it is and how it would always be.
These kids are growing up learning at least one street isn't for cars. It's for them.
That was Jad Slayman reporting. Coming up, we know it's a bad idea. We know it can be deadly. So why can't we stop using our phones while driving?
This is our generation's drunk driving.
That's next on The Pulse.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about cars and how they impact our lives and health. Much of what makes cars dangerous comes from us. Driver error, doing things like speeding, driving drunk, driving super tired, or using our phones. Jackie Tears lost her daughter Danielle in a car crash.
She had been on Snapchat and texting at the time of the accident.
Danielle rear-ended a truck at about 70 miles an hour.
She didn't brake. She never even saw it. It was just a huge blow.
After Danielle's death, Jackie started a campaign called Do It for Danielle. Jackie does a lot of public speaking at schools where she shares facts like this one.
It takes approximately 4.6 seconds to read or send a text message. And in 4.6 seconds at 70 miles an hour, your car can travel the distance of a football field and a half.
We all know that texting in the car, getting on Snapchat, posting on Instagram is a terrible idea, full stop. We know it can have deadly consequences. So why can't we stop? Why do so many drivers still use their phones anyway? Steph Yin looked into this, but first, she has a confession to make.
I'm not proud of it, but I use my phone pretty often while driving. I toggle between podcasts, music, and audiobooks. I surf social media, make calls. I've even written emails. I know the facts, like one in every four car accidents involves cell phones. So why am I making such bad choices? To find out, I talked to Kit Delgado, an emergency physician and professor at the University of Pennsylvania. He's interested in what's called behavioral economics, the factors that go into our flawed decision-making. There's present bias, meaning we give more weight to benefits in the present moment.
People tend to respond to immediate gratification rather than delaying things so that, you know, to prevent crashes in the future.
Then there's overconfidence bias.
If you ask a room of 100 drivers, you know, how they compare to other drivers in terms of their driving safety, 90% will say that they're safer than other drivers.
And recency bias.
You just completed hundreds of trips without getting into a crash. You probably used your phone for some of them. So when that phone ping goes off, you're not even calculating that risk of getting into a crash because you've never experienced it before.
There are lots of efforts to get us to think straight when driving. High schools now run programming around phone use while driving. There are media campaigns to shift cultural attitudes.
No text is worth the risk. It can wait.
And currently, 48 states ban texting and driving by law. Kit's working on the technology side with an app company called TrueMotion that tracks driving behaviors like texting and other distractions. Their idea is to pair good driving with incentives like discounts on insurance or cash rewards. I decided to try one of TrueMotion's apps myself, driving and using my phone as I normally would.
Let me go to a TrueMotion family app, get started on this drive.
But after about 2 weeks using their family app, I got an A+, a perfect score for avoiding distraction. How is that possible? I hopped on a call with TrueMotion to ask about it.
I'm Rafi Feingold, and I am VP of Loyalty and Behavior here at TrueMotion.
First, I asked Rafi how exactly all this works. In short, they're using the motion sensors in your phone, which are extremely sensitive and can sample data up to 100 times a second.
Things like accelerometer, gyroscope, magnetometer, and then in kind of post-processing, we run a bunch of algorithms.
Those algorithms deduce when you're typing or browsing or playing on your phone. TrueMotion doesn't know what content you're looking at or what apps you're on. But from your phone's operating system, they can see when you're making a call and whether your screen is unlocked. Rafi showed me that TrueMotion did in fact register my phone use, but they didn't count it because they considered it passive use. I was tapping and swiping my phone, but in a mount, not in my hand.
And that was kind of a UX decision that we made because we didn't want to ding people for behaviors that they considered to be safe. Having your phone in a mount is probably safer than interacting with your phone in the hand.
Still, Rafi told me that I drove about 13 hours and used my phone in the mount almost 30% of the time. That percentage seemed high to me. If you asked me to give myself a grade, I'd probably give myself a C. I felt distracted. Rafi says TrueMotion's planning to come out with a mounted tap detection feature this year, which should account for some of my concerns. But to be real, my concern goes beyond how well an app can track my driving. What truly worries me is that my impulse to use my phone while driving was really strong, even though I was aware of the consequences. So this is a deeper problem.
The worst offenders, the drivers that are distracted on their phone almost 30% of the time. We call these folks phone addicts.
That's Jonathan Matthews, the CEO of Zendrive, a company that studies driving behavior through data and analytics. Last month, Zendrive published their yearly report based on more than 160 billion miles of driver data. It found that one in every 12 drivers is a phone addict.
This is our generation's drunk driving. We are conditioned to have these devices next to us, 6 feet or less throughout the day. And we become dependent on them. And it's increasingly difficult to think of the time on the road as time that should not be experienced through the smartphone.
Jonathan says smartphones are hacking into reward systems in our brains.
The way notifications and a lot of the experiences on the phone work is they trigger some of the neurochemistry and neuromachinery that was created to help us survive in the wild, the dopamine, the serotonin. Those neurotransmitters are very, very important in regulating pleasure and attention.
He suggests one of the best things you can do to reduce phone use while driving is to practice leaving your phone behind in daily life.
Put the phone in the fridge and go out for a stroll around the block and talk to our neighbors and talk to some strangers, cook a meal, enjoy the weather.
We can also rewire our circuits by reframing what makes us feel good. Make it a goal to drive without using your phone and reward yourself if you succeed. Here's one super easy thing to help. iPhones have a setting called Do Not Disturb While Driving, and Androids have a similar mode. It takes 10 seconds to set up. The setting prevents calls and messages from coming in unless the sender says it's an emergency, which removes the temptation to respond to that message from your boss or your new crush. And it'll send an auto reply to anyone who tries to contact you, so you don't have to worry about leaving people hanging. Kit, the researcher studying incentives at the University of Pennsylvania, thinks if this setting comes as the default on new phones, or people just start using it across the board, it'll simply become a new social norm. And people can customize their away messages. Have fun with it.
I wrote here, boo, I'm right behind you. No, just kidding. I'm driving with Do Not Disturb. While driving turned on, I'll see your message when I get where I'm going.
I set this up on my phone too. And should you text me while I drive, here's what you'll get. Hey there, I'm driving and not trying to get caught riding dirty. I'm working on cutting down my phone use while driving. Join me by going to settings and turning on Do Not Disturb while driving. I'll see your message when I get to my destination, which is hopefully the woods or the beach.
That's Steph Yin reporting. Cars have gotten safer over the decades. They are designed differently. They have airbags. And all of those design changes were tested extensively on crash test dummies. But here's the thing. The dummies themselves may need some improvement. Noam Osband has more.
The year is 1984. Only 14% of Americans regularly wear seatbelts, and the Department of Transportation wants to change that. They decide to make a commercial to convince people to buckle up.
What we tried to do was something humorous. That had never been done before with public service advertising.
That's Jim Ferguson, one of the co-creators of this public service announcement. Their idea?
These crash test dummies, day after day, have been crashing these cars without seatbelts on. It had to be a terrible job.
The ads rolled out in 1985, starring two dummies, Vince and Larry.
Hurry!
Not another windshield taste test. Count me out.
What? The old pro backing down from a motorhome?
Each commercial ended with their memorable tagline.
You could learn a lot from a dummy. Buckle your safety belt.
The ads became an immediate success, a cultural phenomenon. Within a few years, seatbelt usage more than tripled. Dummies are now a staple of automobile testing, but they actually got their start in the military.
Jet safety, basically.
That's Lee Vinzel, assistant professor of science, technology, and society at Virginia Tech.
It was about fighter jets and pilots.
In the 1940s, the American Air Force was designing the first planes that could break the speed of sound. And this led to some important questions. What happens to the body when it moves at supersonic speeds? And what happens to the body when the plane slows down? Lee says a colonel named John Stapp ran much of the early testing, and he typically tested on himself.
In one test, he was going like nearly 600 miles an hour and came to a stop in less than, you know, in a second, and his eyes turned into giant bruises. He couldn't see for like a day.
This wasn't sustainable, so the Air Force started making dummies. In 1949, they created Sierra Sam, often called the first test dummy. It was 5'10", the size of a 95th percentile male, meaning it was taller than 95% of American men. After all, the dummies weren't designed with the wider public in mind.
Most of those pilots would have been white males, right? So in a lot of ways, the early science that undergirds auto safety was very biased in a kind of white male direction.
In the 1950s, car manufacturers began their own crash testing. At first, they used male and female dummies, but by the 1970s, only male dummies were used. Federal car crash testing didn't mandate female dummies until 2011. And even then, female dummies are almost never in the driver's seat for front crash tests that give cars their safety ratings. Moreover, the dummies themselves aren't ideal.
This is not actually an anthropometrically correct female crash test dummy. It's just a scaled down male dummy.
That's Caroline Criado Perez, author of the new book, Invisible Women, Exposing Data Bias in a World Designed for Men.
And of course, women aren't just scaled down men. You know, we differ in various ways. We have different pelvises. We have different muscle mass distribution.
And there's a real pressing need for better data about female drivers.
Women are 17% more likely to die than a man if they're in a car crash, and 47% more likely to be seriously injured. And in fact, the number one cause of fetal death from trauma is car crashes, because we haven't designed a seatbelt that accounts for pregnancy.
Now, these other vehicles we've got here, this is from a very special crash test. Which one?
I went to visit the Insurance Institute of Highway Safety, a nonprofit crash tester founded and funded by auto insurance companies. You've seen their safety rankings in TV commercials. Their test center rotates between 23 different dummies. Dummies are expensive, $200,000 a pop. And obviously, they need a lot of maintenance. This morning, a team finalizes preparation for a front impact research test. It takes 2 days to set up the car. There's an average-sized male in the driver's seat, along with another average-sized male and small female in back.
Does it look reasonable on the chart?
The Institute began using female dummies for side crash testing in the late 1990s, but they too also only use male dummies in the driver's seat for front crash testing. Here's Mike Chacon, Senior Director of Crashworthiness Evaluations.
We added more test scenarios, more crash type scenarios, but we haven't changed the dummies.
Do you guys ever use pregnant dummies?
No, we have not used pregnant dummies. We have used children, though. We do have child dummies.
I head to the other end of the 600-foot runway to watch a perfectly fine 2019 Corolla meet an untimely end at 40 miles an hour. The smashed-up car comes to rest and the team quickly swarms around. The vehicle's emergency response gives the proceedings a gentle soundtrack as Mike and others take detailed notes.
Oh, that's the driver. I mean, this guy. Probably is.
What's that?
Raul Arbeláez is the vice president of the Institute, and I asked him why females aren't used as drivers in front crash testing.
We believe that there are some optimizations that can probably be made, but what we're finding overall is that improvements that have been made for mid-sized male dummies have also helped females.
There's another reason why researchers are reluctant to change. They worry about the impact on data analysis.
We want to compare every vehicle using the same test mode and impact points, and even the way we position the dummies. If we were to change things now, it is very difficult to compare the overall risk of a vehicle 5 years from now from a vehicle several years before, because we again have lost that correlation.
Caroline, who writes about bias in design, is not convinced.
I've heard that so often. It's a massive excuse that comes up in the medical world that, well, we've not tested on women in the past, so we can't start now because we won't have comparable data. Having been sexist in the past and causing women to die as a result is not a reason to carry on being sexist.
Humanetics, America's only crash test dummy manufacturer, is currently developing a new dummy, the Thor series. This newer series will more accurately depict female body structure. That is to say, Thor will have an anatomically correct female pelvis.
That's Noam Osband reporting. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about cars, how they impact our lives, our safety, and health. When you drive a lot, you end up seeing quite a bit of wildlife. But sadly, many times, it's roadkill. Like the first time I ever saw a raccoon when I came to the United States, it was dead on the side of the road. Animals trying to get across roads or highways can also be dangerous or even deadly for drivers. Ecologist Kevin McLean brings us this story about tracking and reducing roadkill in California.
A few years ago, I was driving at night, chatting with my in-laws on a small state highway. Two lanes each direction, huge, grassy median in the middle. I wasn't speeding, but definitely a little bit distracted. I glanced over, and there was a raccoon crawling out of the grass. It didn't look at me, no eye shine, it just jumped straight into the beam of my headlights. I heard it hit at the front of the car, felt it bounce once under our feet, and once more at the back. It was jarring, and I felt a little guilty. But my ecologist brain kicks in, and it's not like I hit a panda or something, you know? Raccoons aren't endangered, they're fine. But that sound stuck with me. It's what I'm thinking about while I ride with Catherine Harold. It's Saturday, just after 5 a.m. Catherine is one of hundreds of citizen scientists throughout California who helped document roadkill. We're out looking for dead animals.
If you're looking, there's also a high amount of tire marks from people veering suddenly out of the lanes.
She cruises down Highway 280, one of the main freeways that connects San Francisco to San Jose. We're in Catherine's small, tan, four-door sedan. With no one else on the road, she's got her high beams on, and she keeps her eyes moving, scanning left to right, searching.
You get kind of used to how to spot them. Some deer, like their legs will stick up a lot in the grasses, so you look for the different shape, right?
The stretch of Highway 280 that Catherine takes day after day is among the very worst in the state for roadkill. There's a lot of undeveloped land. It's great habitat for animals, except that they have to frogger their way across 8 lanes of traffic.
If there's no fence, they're just gonna walk right from the dirt onto the concrete.
Catherine works nights at a bar. She commutes just after nightfall when most animals get hit, but before cleanup crews pick up the carcasses. If a dead animal on the road looks like it could be a hazard to drivers, she calls it into Highway Patrol.
Hazard on Highway 280.
Is it north or south?
I'm going southbound.
What's the nearest exit?
I'm about 1 mile north of Bunker Hill Drive.
Okay, and what is it?
It's a dead buck in the fast lane.
Okay, get out there and make sure to remove it from the lane.
She has a dash cam fixed on the road in front of her. She drives up close and describes the scene to the camera.
And that's a raccoon. And there was a squirrel, both flat. That raccoon looked to be medium size, mangled, buzzard doing its job.
Catherine enters each animal into the California Roadkill Observation System. It's a crowdsourced database that maps roadkill all over the state. Want to know where you're most likely to hit a skunk? There's a map for that. Mountain lions, porcupines, even an elephant seal have been hit on California roads. There are more than 60,000 roadkill entries, complete with some pretty gruesome photos. These collisions can be dangerous for drivers, too.
And some people instinctually swerve. And then when you're going 65 to 80 miles an hour and you just yank your wheel 15 degrees, you're going to fly off the road. And a lot of people do, and they die.
And all this gets expensive, too. The cleanup, property damage, injuries, and even death. The University of California in Davis crunched the numbers. Based on insurance claims, the researchers estimate that in 1 year, roadkill in California costs more than $300 million.
It doesn't tell us about the ecological or conservation impacts. It tells us just about the impacts to people, to society. But often that's the thing that gets the government to respond.
That's Fraser Schilling, the director of the Road Ecology Center at Davis. He manages the roadkill database. To make the roads safer, Fraser recommends building special bridges and tunnels just for animals, giving salamanders and coyotes a way to avoid traffic. In some states, those structures have reduced roadkill by up to 96%. Citizen scientist Catherine Harold is trying to convince the California Department of Transportation that the stretch of highway she monitors has a safety problem. So she's been going through highway patrol records looking for any mention of animals hit or drivers swerving, and she's noted some deaths linked to this route.
Like, it's seriously hard reading people's obituaries. It's totally brutal. Sorry. It's really emotional. Like, it really is sad, you know. It's fixable, which is even more part of the painfulness of it.
She says pushing for change has been slow and frustrating, but Catherine plans to keep her dash cam running for the animal safety and for ours.
That's Kevin McLean. He first reported the story for KALW Radio in San Francisco. Driving can be infuriating. Traffic, red lights, other drivers. And suddenly you're honking and cursing.
Doesn't happen all that often, but when it does, I'm usually rushing somewhere.
That's Lisa Feldman Barrett.
Usually there's time pressure. Somebody cuts me off or gets in my way, and then I want to chase the person down and let them know that they've really pissed me off.
Lisa is a psychology professor at Northeastern University, and she's written a book called How Emotions Are Made, which is all about how the brain constructs emotions. So when she's getting mad in her car, she has a good handle on what's going on.
You're flush with arousal. You have a jittery feeling, a jolt of energy. You're prepared to act in a particular way that's going to deal with the situation.
Deal with it maybe by speeding up, trying to catch up with the other driver. Maybe you want to cut them off too. You're taking risks, being reckless. Lisa says cars can provide us with a false sense of invincibility.
Cars are designed so that you don't have the sensory experiences that would lead your brain to predict danger. You can drive in a car, usually the sound is muffled, the vibration is muffled. You don't actually have a strong sense of how fast you're going.
But Lisa says you don't necessarily have to feel the rage.
It doesn't serve you, and it doesn't serve the other driver. So you can make a different kind of emotion or a different experience with that increase in arousal. You can make curiosity, you can make excitement, or you can just experience it as an increase in arousal because your brain just protected you from danger.
Lisa tries to guide her mind toward curiosity. What is this other person, this bad driver, up to?
That person could, him or herself, be rushing to a sick kid in a hospital, to a dear friend in need. I think the other thing that you can do is you can reduce the arousal. You can take some deep breaths. Measured deep breaths are one of the ways that you can grab a hold of your peripheral nervous system and calm it down. It's really the only way.
What if our cars were designed in a way to help us stay cool in these situations when we're getting stressed out? Javier Hernandez is a scientist at the MIT Media Lab, and he's researching ways in which technology and artificial intelligence could monitor stuff like drivers' heart rates to get a sense of their agitation.
For example, we have studied sensors on the seatbelt, cameras that monitor your facial expressions, your heart rate, your respiration, anything really, any emotional breadcrumb that you leave in the car potentially can be used to capture those things.
And if you're freaking out, your car could respond.
So let's say, for example, you have a 30-minute drive, and we can design the perfect playlist to get you from very aroused and excited to a more subdued and focused state, which might be better for driving.
Or your dashboard could change colors when you're getting really worked up as a warning to tell you, hey, calm down. Javier says this kind of research will also be important with driverless cars because even though you won't be behind the wheel yourself, you could still feel road rage. So your car should be able to react to that. For example, it could pull up your calendar information and let all of your contacts know if you're running behind for a meeting.
Anything in particular you want me to look for?
How
how do you cope with the stress of driving when you drive a lot? More than 4 million people in the U.S. travel at least an hour and a half to get to work, and many of them make that commute either entirely or partially by car. Daryl C. Murphy tagged along with one driver who commutes 60 miles each way but has learned to find moments of zen on the highway.
All right, the journey begins.
Yeah.
I meet Mike Lynch in Center City, Philadelphia, where he works as an IT director for an engineering firm. He's a tall, gray-haired white guy in his early 60s, an active 60s, and his demeanor is very, you know, chill. He commutes here every day from his home in a rural Pennsylvania community called Upper Black Eddy. He's done this for almost 2 decades.
Well, I mean, there's the practical sense in that, you know, the jobs are down here and, you know, the salaries are higher down here.
Mike navigates his Prius down crowded city streets. He often listens to the news.
Yeah, you know, all things considered.
Podcasts, audiobooks, or music.
I'm feeling music mood, you know.
All right. Anwar Brahman. We merge on to 95 North, a major highway, and traffic is at a crawl.
And how do you deal with this? We are looking at, what, 3-4 lanes of traffic.
Dead stop.
How do you get through this?
You know what? Age helps a whole lot. It really does.
You just have the wisdom and the patience now.
I know exactly where along 95 all the dead spots will be, except for the occasional time where you have an accident or, you know, something. There's a rhythm to it, you know, and you get to know it. So it's like, yeah, you know, I expect this. I mean, when I first was doing it, right, I'm tearing my hair out, and you know, it didn't take too long for me to learn. But that still didn't, tamp down the emotions. But, you know, after doing it for 19 years, you know, I know what to expect for the most part. I budget for it, you know, time-wise.
Mike seems relaxed the whole time we're on the highway. He doesn't get mad or frustrated at other drivers. He says that is key to making this all work out.
It's almost, it reminds me, I like to ride, you know, bike ride a lot. I like to hike. And this may sound like heresy, but it's kind of the same thing, you know? You get into a groove, and I can think of other things, you know, I can let my mind wander and roam, right? You know what? They need to get these driverless cars going, you know? It's like, well, how would that change things, huh?
A few times a week, Mike takes the train instead of the car, even though it takes longer.
Free time, you know, to sit and write, and it's a perfect little cocoon, you know, just cruising through the suburbs, you know, my little metal tube, you know.
After about an hour on the highway, our exit comes into view.
And here we are, getting off 95, right?
Oh, we're getting off 95?
Yeah.
All right, exit 10.
We drive along country roads toward Mike's home, a converted carriage house on a green 3-acre property. He's lived here with his wife for about 30 years.
It's a cool place. It's really nice to come back to.
It's unbelievable.
Isn't it? And these trees, that ash tree there?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that ash tree.
That's a big tree.
Yeah.
So that's old.
That's, you know, about, you know, 170, 180 feet tall. Probably, you know, 150 years old.
Oh, man.
Woo. Not a stretch. It's beautiful here and so quiet.
Daryl C. Murphy reported that story.
No traffic. You hear that?
That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, Jad Slayman, and Steph Yin. We had production assistance from Julian Harris. Joseph Fridman contributed reporting to this week's episode. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Xavier Lopez is our associate producer. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral health reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation.
an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare. WHYY's health and science reporting is supported by a generous grant from the Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.